Dreamers, and welcome back to the show. This episode is for those of you who did not want to listen to the 3-hour interview with James Reyes in the last part, episode number 284. I am going to give you many of the details from that interview. We're going to see James go from full denial to full confession, and just a little bit of commentary and reaction on my part. And yes, Jeffrey from Facebook, you're not wrong when you commented on my post that when James is asked one question, he gives at least 3 answers back. It's pretty hilariously amazing. All right, let's get to discussing this. This is going to be a very long episode. So James is paid a visit by 2 investigators, one from the FBI and one from the Shasta County Sheriff's Office. They start off with some small talk. They find James is living there still at the same house where Sherry stayed, and he's helping to take care of his 92-year-old grandmother at that point. This is at the height of COVID. I believe this interview took place in August of 2020. And from what James is saying, he talked about how he used to play minor league hockey. He's still very much involved. That's what he does. I think he works at like a pro shop. He never actually really asked what the investigators were doing there, though. It was about 3 minutes in when one of them was like, "We're here regarding Sherry Papini." And James said, "Okay." So he knows. But what he forgets, and what a lot of people who get surprised by law enforcement forget, is that the chances are that they know a lot of the answers to the questions that they're going to be asking you, at least most of them. But he's going to be evasive for quite some time when they're questioning him, for at least, I want to say, like the first hour. The investigators asked James how he knew Sherry, when was the last time he saw her, and when was the last time they talked, things of that nature. James said that they started dating around 2002. Sherry was first dating a friend of his, and that they all knew each other through some youth program when they were teenagers. He said that their relationship lasted through late 2005 into 2006 because Sherry ended up moving back up to Shasta from Southern California. He said she was going to go to school and that he was still playing hockey down there. And he said that he and Sherry had an apartment in Huntington Beach for about a year. And from the sounds of it, it just seemed like their lives were going in different directions at the time, especially with the work and the traveling that James had to do playing hockey. So about 5 or 6 minutes into their talk, James starts distancing himself from Sherry. He said they broke up around 2006, so that would put that about a decade before the kidnapping hoax, right? So yeah, James said that they broke up, that they still had a few items that belonged to one another, and that they communicated about those things for a period of time following the breakup. A minute earlier, the agents let James know that they've got some questions about Sherry and remind him that it is a crime to lie to a federal agent. So James starts lying less than 6 minutes into their conversation when he says it's been years since they've talked, like a decade. Then James randomly says that he had talked to Sherry's dad, which seemed like an odd thing to say. And he goes back to saying that he hasn't talked to her in like 15 years. So this is 2020. But anyway, James then pivoted back to talking about seeing Sherry's dad. And then he said that Sherry contacted him some years back, maybe about 3 seasons ago. And she told him that her dad was going to be in Orange County for an Anaheim Ducks game, that he met up with her dad at the game, that they didn't go to the game together, but they did meet up for some drinks. James wasn't really wanting to nail down an exact year. He said it was sometime between the 2014 and 2016 season, which is getting pretty close to the time of the kidnapping when that was going to happen. So there, James was caught in another lie. He said a few minutes ago that he hadn't spoken to Sherry in like 15 years, but then all of a sudden, you know, a few years back, she apparently contacted him to go and meet up with her dad, which seemed like a weird thing to me. But anyway, So one of the investigators asked, so you knew that Sherry had gone missing? And James said, yeah, on the news that his mom had called him and told him about it. And then he was asked, so you were in contact with her right before she went missing? And here James kind of goes back to distancing himself again from the whole thing by saying, yeah, she contacted me about her dad coming down for a hockey game, whatever, whatever. And then they asked him, so when was the last time you actually saw her? And James said about a year after they broke up. So he's putting the last time he saw Sherry all the way back to around 2006-ish, maybe 2007. But whatever the year, these investigators already know that it's not true. So James is continuing to lie to a federal agent, which is a felony, and they did warn him of that. But he's admitting to having seen Sherry's dad more recently than he had seen Sherry, which, again, I think is very strange. So James is basically going on and on about where he moved around the Orange County area and roommates that he had and things of that sort. He's kind of rambling, which might be a manifestation of his nervousness. I don't know. He seemed pretty calm and collected, but, you know, this is some 4 years after the fact. A lot of times when there is time and distance between when the crime happens and when the investigators randomly show up at your door, there's probably some level of feeling like you could talk your way out of things. And James may not have necessarily done anything wrong when he helped Sherry, but he is definitely in the beginning stages of painting himself into a corner with this FBI agent and this sheriff's investigator. They asked him when the last time he was in Shasta County or in Redding, California, and he said 2004, which is another lie. He said that he visited the area with Sherry for Thanksgiving and for Christmas and spent that year with her family during the holidays. James said that he knew Sherry from high school, but they didn't start dating until later on. The investigators asked him what Sherry's relationship was like with her parents around the time when he met up with their dad for that Anaheim Ducks game that he mentioned sometime in 2014 or 15 or 16. But James really didn't answer the question. He said that there was a period of time when Sherry didn't see her parents for like a year. And then he brought up getting in touch with Sherry to see if she could pick up his cousin in Oregon and bring him down to San Francisco or something like that. I don't know. It was a very answer, non-answer. And then James said that when he reconnected with Sherry in 2001 or 2002, that's around the time that they started dating. So James is continuing to try to put a lot of time and space between himself and Sherry. Like most people who ever encounter Sherry Papini in real life probably try to do the same. James then talked about how he had a napkin from a coffee house where he worked or something like that that had Sherry's number on it. And during one of his moves, he found it. And he said he gave her a call, and that's how they reconnected after high school. They started talking, and she came down to Orange County. And from there, he said whatever was going on with her parents, he didn't know too much about that. But then the agent interrupted him and said that he wanted to talk about the time around the hockey game that James said that he met up with Sherry's dad, the thing that only happened like 3 or 4 years ago. So James here is talking about his interactions with Sherry from almost 20 years earlier. And the FBI agents, while they're patient, they're not having it, and they're leading him back to the question at hand. They want to know how it all came about, how he ended up linking up with her dad randomly a decade or so after they broke up. Now, what I'm thinking, because he put this interaction with Sherry's dad close in time to the fake kidnapping, what I think James is trying to do is account for any type of communication between himself and Sherry that took place in 2016 as she was planning this whole convoluted hoax. So I'm fairly certain that James knows what's going on, but he is really trying to distance himself. I'd distance myself from that crazy bitch too if I were him. I mean, who really does this kind of stuff? It's insane. It's totally insane what Sherry Papini did. So James again starts to ramble. He said that he hadn't been anywhere in forever, that he doesn't travel, that he doesn't go to Canada to play hockey or anything like that. And the agent was like, I'm just trying to figure out the context in which this interaction with Sherry's dad happened. Did Sherry just tell her dad, hey, there's this guy that I used to know who played minor league hockey. Maybe he can show you around town and the hockey game or whatever. And James said that Sherry's dad knew that he played hockey, but he's not really sure what caused Sherry to reach out to him about meeting up with her dad. And granted, that does sound random, and I'm not even really sure if it happened like that or not. Like I said, I think he could be trying to make up a reason to have been in contact with Sherry around 2016, the year that the kidnapping took place. But anyway, James just said that she contacted him and said that her dad was going to be in Orange County and that he hadn't seen her in almost 10 years and he didn't know. He had only met her parents a couple times. They didn't really travel to Southern California to visit Sherry or anything. He was under the impression they just weren't close. Well, we do know that Sherry and her parents had somewhat of a tumultuous relationship. I mean, we know that both of her parents and her sister contacted their local law enforcement regarding some of the things that they accused Sherry of doing. As a reminder, I believe her father reported that Sherry tried to do some illegal transactions or a withdrawal on his bank account. Her mother contacted the sheriff and said that Sherry was injuring herself and trying to accuse her of doing it to her and was seeking advice on what to do about it. And Sherry's sister said that someone tried to break into her back door and she believed it was Sherry who was responsible for it. I mean, it isn't often that we have cases where parents report their kids to police for stuff like this because it can mess up their lives and parents will deal with it the best way they can on their own if it's possible. But I have a feeling that there was likely a weird history with Sherry behaving this way. Like, I don't think her parents resorted to contacting their local law enforcement right from the start, but I can't say for sure, but it seems like she would have been having to act up with her family for quite some time for it to get to the point where they made the decision to report her to the sheriffs, you know? That's like a big deal. So anyway, getting back to James, he said that he did not see Sherry's dad at the hockey game, but rather met up with him at the bar in the lounge at the arena where they had some beers. So to clarify, the agent asked James, so the last time you ever saw Sherry or had any kind of sexual relationship with her was in 2006 or 2007-ish? And again, James avoided the question and started talking about his apartment lease with Sherry from 2003, and then how he had another lease in 2004, and that he was living in Huntington Beach with a buddy, and she was there, but she had to move back to Shasta County to go back to school. Then she would come back down to Orange County to pick up some more of her stuff as they navigated through this transitional period in their relationship. James veered off topic again and said that they had gotten a car together, but he couldn't afford it. So he had an uncle pay it off, but it was Sherry that was the one driving back and forth between Shasta County and Orange County, and all of that was happening closer to 2005 and 2006. The agent steers James back to the time frame around that supposed hockey game that he met Sherry's dad at. He wanted to know about the time between 2014 and 2017, which takes us into the weeks and months following the November 2016 staged kidnapping. The agent asked in that time period if there was any exchange of belongings that may have been left behind when she moved out about a decade earlier, and James said no. They didn't have any interaction in that time frame. So he's lying some more to the agents. And James, again, goes off topic and starts talking about the hockey game that he went to with Sherry's dad, that he was a backup player there, that he used to do that, but not anymore because he's gotten too old. But he would be paid $500 to just suit up and sit there in case they needed him. Then he said that he was close with her parents when they were in a relationship, but he had never met her parents during the time that they were in high school. But I'm fairly certain that earlier in this interview, James said that he didn't know her parents that well and only saw them a couple of times because, of course, Sherry did not have a great relationship with them, which would make sense. This whole thing with Sherry contacting James out of the blue to go have some beers with her dad at a Ducks game actually makes very little sense when you think about it. I mean, why would this dad want to link up with an old boyfriend of his daughter's, a daughter that he doesn't even have a good relationship with, to meet up with him at the bar for beers? It doesn't sound like that's a thing. So the investigator, again trying to get the conversation back on track, asked James, okay, so why do you think she would have been taken? And James said that he really didn't know. As far as any mental issues, that they grew up together as friends, and you really don't get into deep stuff until later, and that he really doesn't know a lot about her history prior. He's not really sure. He doesn't know much about Northern California. James said that he had only been to Redding twice and that it's really small. And then James said that we haven't had contact and I don't know what kind of person she is now, like who she is. I just don't really know much about her. And the agent asked if he had any family in the Redding area, and James said that he did not, that all of his family is in Southern California, along with a couple of cousins in Florida. Again, he's going off topic. The agent is trying to see if there were any other reasons why James would visit the area where Sherry lived other than to see Sherry. And James said no, that he doesn't even really leave the Orange County area because he works 6 days a week, usually 60 hours each week typically. But at the time that this interview was taking place, it was at the height of COVID and he was taking care of his elderly grandmother because she's in hospice and they didn't want to put her in a facility because no one would be able to visit her because of COVID restrictions. So he hadn't been keeping up those same kind of work hours as of late. And then James goes off topic again and starts talking about the possibility of moving to Arizona to help take care of his grandfather and his grandma's ex-husband because he had a heart attack. And James is rambling again about the house being in his name and that he might be going, maybe not yet because of his aunt. They're dealing with his grandpa in the hospital and blah, blah, blah. And they can't go see him right now because of COVID, so it might be another year before he moves. Finally, after about 18 minutes of this nonsense, one of the investigators says to James, look, we're getting to a point where we are here for a reason. And James is like, yeah, for sure. And they let him know that one of them is from the FBI and the other one is from the Shasta County Sheriff's Office. So they tell him that they're the ones who have been investigating Sherry's abduction, and that is the reason for their visit to him, that they got there because they found some evidence that tied James to the abduction side of things. Not from this, I haven't seen her in 10 years nonsense. The agent then asked about having exchanged anything that belonged to her. Did he exchange anything with her parents? And James said no, but that she had sent him his hockey jersey back to him years back because he had given it to her. Again, going off on another tangent, that he gave it to her when they were together, but that her dad didn't bring it or give it to him, that she had shipped it to him because he had asked for it back, that he had given it to her as a gift, that it was his only professional jersey and it had his signature on it, but he wanted it back since they were no longer together, and that if she wanted to get rid of it, to please give it back to him. However, the investigators cut James off again and said, you know, we're not here to jam you up, but we do want to understand the truth of what happened with Sherry, and they believe him to have some of that information that they're looking for. They're just not sure if he doesn't want to tell them or if he doesn't really know what to do, but they assure him that at that point, he hasn't broken any laws, even though James technically has committed several felonies there lying to a federal agent. But I know that they want to get him talking, and so they're not going to start telling him that they're going to charge him with felonies. So, you know, James is for sure knowing where this is going. In the back of his mind, he knows. They told him that they've been very cordial with him, but there are some things. There is some information that they believe he has about Sherry's abduction that they want to know. But James still isn't quite ready to talk or to implicate himself in the abduction hoax. So he tells the investigators in a rambling way, yeah, I mean, you know, that's all I can't, I don't know. All I know is what I read about it. And, you know, I tried to look it up and to see what was going on because my mom called me. I mean, I have TV, but it's just like whatever. I don't plug it in. I don't really watch it. The agent interrupts James again and tells him, look, we're getting on a slippery slope here. We want to stop you before you start falling. And they break the news to him. Your DNA was found with her at the time that she was recovered. So there's evidence that says you were around when she was found. And James said, well, I was at work, but the agent just kept going. That's not what we're talking about. During the abduction time, your DNA was found on her. And it's not by chance. In your own words, you say you haven't seen her in 10 years. She hasn't been down here. You've only talked to her dad like a few seasons before. We're not down here for no reason. We're just trying to understand how your DNA got there, what the situation is around it, if she was truly abducted, or if she is lying to everyone, if she got on 2020 and is a liar. And James interrupted the agent and said, yeah, that's where I've seen it. And the agent said, so we don't know where all of this is, but we do know that you are the bridge to that information because you're the only DNA, and it's a specific DNA. And I'm sure you've heard of touch DNA. You've heard of different types of DNA. And they tell him again, your DNA was on her when she was found. So we know she was with you, or she was close to you, or a house that you've been at. Then they further tell James, now we've obviously came here prepared. We've done our homework, like when your vehicle had been spotted by license plate readers, and they show him a bunch of different dates and times and places that his license plates were recorded. So they tell James that they know his car was parked at home the day that she was released, but James kept saying that he was at work. And they remind him that it was Thanksgiving Day, so James tries to spin another story about picking up his grandmother and taking her down to San Pedro, which is true. He did do that. I believe he did it after he got back from dropping Sherry off back in Redding. He came back down and celebrated Thanksgiving. And he said to the agents or the investigators, if they wanted to call his aunt, that she would back up his story. But the investigators are being really patient and they're just not putting up with James's BS. Finally, the investigators tell him, look, your DNA was on her clothes. And I'm thinking that here, they're not exactly being completely truthful with him because they're telling him that the DNA that they found on her clothing was fresh, that it wouldn't be from 10 years ago. But I mean, basically, it's true. There really isn't any way for his DNA to be on something that she was wearing or had on the morning that she was found because it had been a long time since they had seen each other. But we do know that DNA can be identified years, even decades later, but that isn't the case here. They're making him think that DNA can degrade to a point where it can't be tested anymore, which isn't true. I mean, it can. It just depends. But, you know, we've had cold cases get solved out from DNA being tested many, many, many years down, like decades later. So anyway, they also told James that the DNA came from seminal fluid. Now, when I heard this, I thought maybe they did have sex. But from everything that I've read and heard, I don't think that they did. I think she was sleeping on his bed and it's probably, you know, his mess. So they may have just been telling James that to worry him or to get him talking. It may not have been seminal fluid. I'm not really sure. Because in the next recording, we're going to hear them, the recording that I'm going to post after this is when they confront Sherry about what she did, and they're going to tell her that they know that she and James did not have sex because they asked him on a polygraph, and the result of that specific question was the truth when he said that they didn't. But I mean, you know, it could have been DNA from seminal fluid. It was his home. It could have come from anywhere. But whatever the case is, the source of the DNA, they know for sure, was a match to him. So they're telling him that they want to know how his DNA got on Sherry when he says that he hasn't seen her in 10 years. And at that point, once the investigator said seminal DNA fluid, James said that he would probably need to talk to an attorney. So in order to try to keep James talking, the investigators tell him that Sherry hasn't implicated him in anything criminal, that she hasn't said that he was the one who injured her, she hasn't alleged that he sexually assaulted her or anything, but there is this seminal fluid DNA that was on her clothing, and James being James, he just randomly started talking about something off topic. And I've listened to this recording of him twice now, and there's a part of me that doesn't really think he's playing with the full deck completely. He said that there must be something going on with her, that her dad told him that Sherry almost died from a variety of complications when she gave birth to her second child, and that he thinks that she's a very sick girl. I don't understand why this guy agreed to do all this stuff for Sherry, renting cars, driving 1,000 miles round trip twice to go get her and to drop her back off, keeping her hidden for 22 days. His family knew about it. Some members of his family knew that she was there. Sherry was all over the news. They knew that she was hiding at his house. And I guess James must have told his mom and his brother and his cousin that Sherry was being abused by Keith. So they all kept this quiet all these years. Nobody ever came forward, which is kind of amazing, too. I don't think I'd be able to keep a secret like that. I'd probably have to blab to somebody. But anyway, at that point, James asked if he could get back to them because he wanted to talk to an attorney. But I know that these investigators traveled all the way down there, and this interview is going to continue for another couple hours. So they just kept talking to James, interrupting him as he again expressed his concern about the source of the DNA found on Sherry. They tell him that he really isn't going to be able to explain away this DNA being from some time in the past, that when she was found, she had his DNA on her, and they needed an explanation for that. They try to reassure him that they're not accusing him of anything, but they are fairly certain that James has the information that they're looking for when it comes to what happened to Sherry during those 22 days that she was gone, that he is the one, the only one, who can fill in the blanks. But then, off topic, James started talking about his girlfriend being on Australia, being in Australia, not on Australia. I guess, well, technically, on Australia is an island, sort of. Anyway, that they've been together for 4 years, but this was during COVID, and they hadn't been able to travel to see each other. James mentioned that she's a figure skating coach and that they were introduced through a mutual friend. The investigator again steered the conversation back to him, bringing up wanting to speak to an attorney, but they still want to talk to him while they're there. And James just said, yeah, I know, it's just all this legal stuff and I don't understand any of it. So now he's trying to play dumb, which I guess maybe isn't that much of a stretch for him. The investigators tell him that we know it's scary to hear about your seminal fluid being on her. We get it. But they asked if he was going to stick to his story that he hadn't seen Sherry since the mid-2000s. And James again rambled on about having exchanged some of their belongings in the intervening years. And then he spoke to her when he met up with her dad for that hockey game. And they asked again, are you sure? Nothing between him and Sherry ever since the mid-2000s. And James again circles back to having spoken to her about meeting up with her dad. And the investigator asks, so you're saying you had nothing to do with the abduction? And James said, nope. I mean, I'm just as surprised as you guys. And they asked, and you don't know who took her? You don't know where she was held? And James replied, I know I've seen her online or talking to someone. The only people I know on the East Coast, the only guy that I know out there that she knows is Matt, and I think that's another ex-boyfriend who is also friends with James. I know this is just really strange, but he's in Chicago, and they ask him why he's bringing up the East Coast, and James mentioned how in the news it was reported that Sherry was talking to a man from Michigan, which is not the East Coast, but this guy doesn't strike me as the most studious person ever either. But yeah, there was a report about Sherry talking to a guy from Michigan, and I think that's what James was trying to refer to. So he continued rambling about how he hadn't seen Sherry's ex-boyfriend since they were in high school. But again, the investigator really isn't having it anymore and said, Sherry was taken on November 2nd, 2016. Where would you have been that day? This ought to be good, right? James said he was probably working. The only days that he doesn't work are Fridays. So they tell James, okay, we're going to go pull your work records and it will show that you were on at work that day. And James said, most likely, I'd have to see what day it was that the skate shop that he works at has three locations. There's one in Los Angeles, one in Anaheim, and one in Irvine, and that he works Saturday through Thursday every week. And the investigator asked him how they do it. Do they have time cards? And James said, yeah. My boss has time cards, but then he says I'm on salary, so he doesn't clock in and out. So, I mean, which is it? Does boss have time cards or he doesn't use time cards? This guy contradicted himself literally in the same sentence. So anyway, they take down James's boss's name and tell him that they're going to speak to him. Okay, so at this point in the audio, it's hard to hear because they are in Costa Mesa. And in the background, I keep hearing airplanes going by, and that's the John Wayne International Airport. But from what I can hear, they're asking James about the big SUV that Sherry claimed to have been abducted in. And James brought up a family member of his that has an SUV, a black Ford Excursion, which is his cousin. The one who lives nearby lives on like the same block as him. So whenever James was at work, if someone was at the door, when Sherry was there, Sherry would contact James and James would call his cousin and have him try to keep people away from the house because Sherry was inside. So the whole country was looking for this woman, right? And she just did not want to be seen because I think she's relatively recognizable. I mean, she's kind of basic, but whatever. So anyway, James said that they can go see his cousin's SUV if they want, that it's parked on the street. And so they go and do that. And while they're walking, the audio gets really distorted some more. And I know it's hard to listen with all this background noise, which is why if you gave up listening to it, I wanted to give you as many details on here in this episode as I possibly could. So they asked James if he had the same phone number as he did back in 2016, and he said that he did. But we know that he and Sherry communicated on prepaid burner phones. So as they're walking, you can hear landscapers and traffic and airplanes. It's so annoying and hard to hear what they're saying at some points in this audio recording. I was able to hear the investigator ask James or say to James, here's the thing. Like, why would you be motivated to be involved in something like this? So they're totally ignoring James's denials that he was involved. Why even talk to her? Why even care about her? And James said that they had a clean breakup. When they split, we just said like, hey, that's it. And the investigator said, and that's the part that doesn't make sense. Why would you want to get back with her? And it doesn't even really sound like James even answered the question. I don't even know if he heard the question. So then they said, look, there's no getting around the fact that you were somehow, some way around Sherry during this time that she was missing. There's no way to defend that. There's no way to say that I wasn't there. You don't have that option. Without a doubt, you were. The two of you shared the same space during that time. That's the hard part. What you don't know, what you don't understand, is that there's no denying this. The investigator then pivots the conversation and said, we know that Sherry and her father don't get along, which is where I'm thinking that they're letting him know that it's highly unlikely that Sherry set her dad up to meet up with her ex-boyfriend, who they barely know each other. The investigator brought up how they know that there had been a major fight one Christmas, that they know that Sherry has a strained relationship with her family. James replied that it's Sherry's mom that would be the one that would get crazy at times. Maybe James is going to try to stick to his story about having been in contact with Sherry and her dad in a time frame that included the window of time that Sherry was abducted. So James then fesses up to having mailed a box of pictures and papers to Sherry in 2015, something like that. It's hard to hear, but he's inching closer. He said that he called up there to let them know that he sent a package. So he's creating an alibi for any phone calls between himself and Sherry or Sherry's family in that time period. The investigator pivoted again and asked who he knows that has a gravel driveway and a raised foundation like on a mobile home. Those are two details that Sherry gave about the place where she was being held. And obviously this guy lives in a city. There's not going to be any gravel driveways in Costa Mesa. Who does he know that lives in a rural area in a mobile home? And James said that his brother just moved into a mobile home recently, but they're asking about back in 2016. And James was like, no, no one he knew lived in a rural area in a mobile home with a gravel driveway. So that was a lie that Sherry made up to steer the investigation in the wrong direction. She was in a very urban area, the city of Costa Mesa. It's very busy, very much not rural. James then brings up the fact that his brother moved to a mobile home in San Diego. Totally irrelevant. I don't know. I feel bad for this guy. But he walked into this mess by agreeing to help that woman. So I guess the thing that would make sense is if he truly believed that Sherry was a victim of domestic violence, then yeah, he would want to help. But it also seems like Sherry had garnered herself a reputation as a liar. And it seemed like James would have an inkling that she's kind of batshit crazy. The one thing that the investigators would go on to find out about James from the people that they spoke to is that he's just a really, really super nice guy. And he probably did genuinely think that he was helping Sherry. And maybe I've been a little bit hard on him. I think I would be nervous and rambly too if the FBI showed up at my front door. But then again, he's also kind of coming off as a little bit gullible as well. The investigators then asked if his brother was involved at all with the abduction, and he said no, not at all, that they weren't that close growing up because of their age difference, that there were 13 years between them. And he said that he had another brother named Nick who passed away. When Sherry gets confronted, one of the few things that she did admit to when it came to James is that she last spoke to him when his brother died. Now, that wasn't true, but I think she did speak to him when his brother passed away. James said that Nick lived with him for a year or two, that he helped him get a job, that he had been messing up. And then James randomly brought up another friend named Billy, and he's rambling so bad at this point, I don't even know what he's talking about. And then they ask James, the investigators ask him, who drives a silver Nissan or Mitsubishi SUV? James said that no one that he's aware of. At this point in the conversation, they're back at James's place of residence. And this is when you're going to start hearing parakeets that James has in the house. It continues to be so annoying in the background. James pointed out a picture of his deceased brother, and the investigator asked if that picture was taken inside his house, and he said that it was. And this is how the investigator got the first opportunity to get a look inside the home. And he does so by asking if he can see where this picture of his brother was taken. James hesitated for a second, but at the same time, he's also trying to be as cooperative as he possibly can. So he does let the investigators inside. And this is the first time that they're getting to see the place that Sherry had described to them 4 years earlier. The two investigators whisper to each other about the wood paneling on the wall, which is one of the things that Sherry described. They asked about the table that was in the picture, but James said that it broke a while ago. But it is a picture of a table that seemed to match Sherry's description of the table inside the house that she was kept in. James said he just threw it away because it was damaged, and he said that the kids jumped on it and broke it. I believe it's his brother's kids. So this would be the table that I believe that Sherry said that she was laid on or held down on while she was being branded on her back. You can actually tell in this audio recording that the investigators are excited to be seeing the inside of this house. They're looking around at the carpeting Well, James talks about how he and his friends partied over the years and spilled beer and whatnot. So finally, one of the investigators says to James, look, here's the thing. This is the table that Sherry said she was on when she was branded. That she showed them a picture of a very similar table, and that's what the table looked like. And James at this point was quiet, and all he had to say was like, yeah. And the investigators were like, yeah. At this point in the conversation, the investigators then tell James that they have not spilled the beans to Sherry yet, that they've identified him as a match to the DNA on her clothing, that they wanted to come and speak to him first. James tries to avoid that by saying, yeah, you know, I literally had that table just until about a month ago. They want him to understand what's going on. Either one of two things happened, the investigator says to him. Either she came down here on her own, and we don't know why, or you arranged to have her brought down here. And James is like, no, I'm not involved in any of that. But they made it clear, if Sherry is lying, we want to know. If you're lying, we want to know. One of the two of you are lying. And James, at this point, is still sticking with his denials by saying that he wishes that there was more that he could do to help. All he does is work and take care of his grandmother. But the investigator cut him off and says, look, we're on this merry-go-round. Nobody is saying anything about what you did or didn't do. And James again says that he wishes that there was more that he could do to help. But they're like, look, if we leave here and go and talk to Sherry, and Sherry comes clean to me because I've been talking to her at least once a month for the past 4 years, and I go and tell her that the DNA came back to James Reyes, there's a chance that she's going to go ahead and tell her story. And maybe she'll say something like, yeah, I drove down there. I was in a bad spot. There were these rumors going around that she's seeing other men. And they let James know that this is the stuff that they already know. So if Sherry came down to Costa Mesa and things got out of hand, X, Y, and Z happened, she came up with this whole elaborate story, and then you took her back up there. They want to limit his fear when it comes to his involvement in Sherry's so-called abduction. If she called you and came down here to hang out, and then she came up with the plan to hide, who thinks leaving their husband's going to turn into national news? James at this point is starting to get nervous, I think, from what I can hear. He keeps trying to interrupt and talk over the investigator. And the birds in the background are really getting annoying at this point in the recording. But they're still telling James, look, this is your opportunity to tell us your side. Because I'm going to go back up to Shasta County and I'm going to talk to her tomorrow. And she's going to tell me what happened. Because now there's irrefutable problems. Because before it was a bunch of I don't knows. I don't know where she was. I don't know who was there. I don't know any of this. I don't know any of that. But now he has an idea of where Sherry was because of the picture that she provided of the table that she was on and the picture of James's brother standing next to that very table. They tell James that they have an idea that James was there because of his DNA. So the amounts of I don't knows is getting smaller and smaller by the minute. Because he says he believes Sherry was inside his house for a portion of the time. Maybe not the entire time, but a portion of it. She gave us a certain amount of information that's turning out to be true in order to keep her story going. Her story made national news. Now she's going to have to be in this position where she's going to need to save face. James is still being kind of quiet at this point, but they continue to tell him, look, a lot of this stuff we already know. We've investigated it. But they're giving him the opportunity to tell them the truth. For example, they told him that they know that all of his phone activity stopped that the day Sherry was taken. James was like, okay. And then they tell him that it didn't start up again the same way as it had previously until after she was released. And James continued to say that he didn't know what else to tell them, so he's still denying that he took part in Sherry's so-called kidnapping. And then it gets to this point in the conversation where one of James's parakeets gets away and the investigators take a moment to help him catch the bird, which is pretty funny when you think about it. I mean, they're there to confront him about Sherry Papini and her 22-day kidnapping odyssey, and they end up catching wayward birds. I think it's pretty funny. So eventually they get the conversation back at hand, and what they basically are telling James is if he wants to get ahead of this, it's time to come with the truth. Otherwise, they're going to go and talk to Sherry, and there's a very good chance that she's going to continue to play the role of the victim, and that is going to put him in a very precarious position, that he's going to have some problems if Sherry decides to do that. And they're actually not wrong. When we get to the fourth and final audio recording that I'm going to play for you, Sherry is going to continue to try to stick to her story despite the evidence that they have against her. So they tell him, if he has an explanation, they're all ears because they want to get to the truth. They want to get the truth from him rather than from her because she's been lying to them for almost 4 years at that point. They remind James that all of this is going to come out in the news, and it's not going to look good for his DNA to have been found on Sherry. And at this point, it's starting to sound like James is weighing his options and thinking about what might be best for him. And they tell him that they can't force him into saying anything or opening up about his part in what happened, but they know that he was involved and that they have the evidence, and that evidence is irrefutable. That if they go to Sherry and she says that he was the one that kidnapped her, that he was the one who assaulted her, that he was the one who branded her, and that he was the one who broke her nose, and he was the one that covered her in bruises, if she decides to go that route, then there's nothing that they can do for him in terms of helping him get ahead of this mess. James finally tells him, okay, I get it. I'm listening to you guys. But then he gets sidetracky again and started talking about his birds. But they get back on topic pretty quickly, and they tell James, if the things that they've been saying up to them, the things that he has been saying to them up to that point are a bunch of lies, it wasn't too late to correct that. But if they leave, and he's going to be stuck with the story that he didn't have anything to do with what happened to Sherry, then they're going to have to, they tell him, not only are you hiding the truth, but you're lying to us. And James kind of sounds a little bit defeated and goes, yeah. And he mentions that he's probably going to go to jail, and he's worried because he's the one that takes care of his grandmother. He brings up talking to an attorney again, but they want to keep James talking because it feels like he's about to crack finally. And they tell him that he has complete control over what happens, but if he wants to get an attorney, they're going to keep asking the same questions, and that doesn't change the fact that his DNA was found on Sherry's clothing. That it's up to him if he wants to fill in some of the missing pieces of the puzzle. But regardless of whether he talks to them then or through an attorney, there's no denying his involvement. And that his attorney is going to be asking him the same thing. How were you involved in Sherry's disappearance? James tried to change the subject again by bringing up that his grandma's hospice nurse was coming, and he doesn't want these investigators around when she gets there. But they completely ignored him, and they're like, they get him back on track, and they said, they asked him if there were two Hispanic women involved. Did he travel to Northern California with two women? James does a little bit more rambling and chasing down another bird, and finally, one of the investigators says to him, are you willing to talk to us or not? After James corrals the bird once again, he finally says to the investigators, what am I looking at here? You know, she was a good friend of mine. I didn't kidnap her. She was a friend in need asking for help. And they asked him how she asked for help, and he seemed to have a little trouble remembering, but he said it was most likely a text message or somewhere like on social media or something like that, that it may have been from a prepaid phone. But James said she was doing whatever it was she was doing, and I was just here. They asked what it was that she was in need of, and James said that whatever the problem she was having was with her husband, and that was that. She had something planned up, and he just agreed to help. She was the one that said that she was in distress and that she had made police reports about her husband, but he's just going off what she's telling him. that he hadn't seen her in a long time. One of the investigators pointed out that they know he's nervous, and James, true to form, says, "No, I'm fine talking to you, but yeah, he's nervous for himself." That's what he said after he said he was fine. They reassure him that they're going to start small. You can't abduct someone who called you and asked you to do it. And James again goes off on a tangent and said he wouldn't just drive up there for no reason. But the investigator just blows past his rambling and tells James that you can't assault someone who calls you up and asks you to assault them. James just said that he told her, "Whatever your plan is, just whatever happens to me, happens to me." And the investigator asked what was planned out. James said that he wasn't sure exactly what was going on because there's always two sides to a story, and he was just getting Sherry's side, and that he asked her what was going on. Does her husband beat her or what? Does he rape you? Does he want your kids? And she was just saying she was having a hard time. But other than that, she wasn't telling him. He knew very little about the two of them, about Keith and Sherry and their relationship. He was aware that she got married and that he doesn't know Keith at all. All he knows is that she got married. And it's at this point that James comes clean. The investigator asked him what happened next, and he said that was it. He went and he got her. They asked in what car. He said that he got a rental car. His car wasn't in great shape to make that long of a drive. They asked him what kind of car, and he said he couldn't exactly remember. He thought maybe it was some type of SUV, but I believe the SUV was the drop-off car. The first car that he got was a Dodge Challenger. He says that he thinks he got it at the Enterprise car rental place at the John Wayne Airport. If they go over there and if he sees it, he'll remember which place he got the car from. James said that he never actually went to Sherry's house, that he actually didn't know where she lived, and that he still doesn't know where she lives. He said that he went down some road, not a dirt road, a paved road. And they asked him how he knew where to go, and he said that she sent him messages telling him where to go. He said that in the past, the only time he had ever gone anywhere in Reading was to her parents' house, and that he's not familiar with the area, and he had no idea where he was or what road he was on, that he just picked her up. It wasn't anything crazy, that she just got into the car, and that he himself never got out of the car. He said that he unlocked the door and she got into the back seat. And from there, they drove back down to Southern California, that he needed to go straight back because he had to go to work the next day. The investigators wanted to show James a map of Reading so that maybe he could tell them exactly where he picked Sherry up from. James said that they just came right back to his place, that his place was a big mess at the time, because he and his brothers and his cousins, all they did was party, and none of them had girlfriends at the time. So the investigator pulls up maps and shows James the general area where Sherry lived. He sees a road that looks like it was familiar. He thought it was the road where he picked Sherry up from, but he was having a hard time remembering exactly. But I think he was able to recognize it as being Old Oregon Trail Road, and that it was near a Motel 6 and some gas stations and maybe a truck stop. James said that the roads were paved, but it was pretty wide open and the houses were kind of scattered around and some of the roads were windy. The investigators asked him, "So you just get this random message from Sherry to come pick her up and you just go?" And James said that they did talk about it for a while, like she had this whole plan going on. They asked James if he saw her put her phone down. If you recall, Sherry's phone was found laying on the ground near their mailboxes, and the earbuds were neatly wound up and placed on top along with some of her hair that she pulled out and left behind with the phone so it would look like an abduction. And James said that they drove straight back down to Orange County. I don't even think he answered the question. That they stopped a couple of times for coffee and to go to the bathroom, but she mostly stayed in the back seat and then she took a nap. James said that he acknowledged to Sherry that this was something that he could get in trouble for, but you know, He was just trying to help, and he wasn't interested in trying to figure out why she was doing what she was doing. In his words, he just put his head down and did his thing. James said Sherry told him that she was reporting things to her local law enforcement, but they weren't doing anything about it. So this was her solution, apparently. I think I heard, if I remember correctly, from the final video or the audio that I'm going to upload when they confronted Sherry about the big lie, that she told James that Keith had friends in law enforcement that weren't going to do anything to help her. Not that he was going to go up there to do anything, James said. And the investigators were like, yeah, no, you're just being there for a friend in need. You went up there and kind of arranged. And James cut him off and said, she arranged. I just kind of agreed. And they asked James if he happened to save all those old text messages between them. And he said that he was just about to go to the store to get a new phone because the phone that he had isn't holding a charge, but everything should transfer over. And they asked if he and Sherry took any pictures, and he said no. James said the whole time Sherry stayed inside his house and he went to work every day and just kept up with his daily routine with all the hockey stuff. They asked James who all knew that she was there, and he said it was just him and her, but I think we know that that isn't completely true. His cousin, who lived up the street, was aware that she was there. And I believe his mom knew at some point, maybe not right off the bat, but she heard the news early on and called up James and asked him about it. And then eventually, I think he told her at some point that she was actually at his house. But everyone kept their mouth shut all those years, like I said. It seemed to me like it would be kind of a hard thing to do. However, if James told them that he was helping her hide from her abusive husband, then that would be a pretty good reason to keep quiet. But anyway, James said that he was gone most of the time and Sherry just stayed there. She did some cleaning. She did her thing. That's what he said. He said that he slept on the couch while she slept in the bedroom. I think he had two bedrooms, but one of them was full of junk. Sometimes she slept in one or the other bedroom. I think he managed to clean up some of the space for her. And he just said he wanted to give her space to deal with whatever she had going on with herself. One of the investigators asked if he could look inside the room to see if the closet matched how Sherry described it to them. And James agreed to let them look. And from what it sounds like, James's grandmother was in the bedroom at the time that the investigators went in. There's TV going on in the background, and they asked if it's okay if they took pictures of the room. They also asked if they could take pictures of the bathroom, to which James also agreed. The next thing the investigators brought up to James were the significant injuries that Sherry suffered during the 22 days. But I mean, is it really suffering if you do it to yourself? I'm going to say no, but she did mess herself up pretty badly, which, like I've said before, made her story kind of believable. Anyway, the investigators brought up the branding on Sherry's shoulder blade and the extensive bruising on her body, and they asked how all of that happened. James said that she did most of that to herself. When she was in there, she would just hit herself on something. He said that he helped her, and I think he was referring to the branding and possibly the broken nose. I believed he helped her do that as well. But James said that he never punched her. He never laid a hand on her. The investigator asked how he helped her then, and James admitted that one of the things that she wanted him to do was to hit a hockey puck into her legs, which he said that he did, but he pointed it out that he did it just enough to create a bruise that he didn't like full on like slap the puck as hard as he could into her leg. They asked about the large bruise on her arm. James again started rambling and said you could kind of tell he's kind of embarrassed or ashamed that these investigators would think that he would cause all of those injuries on her. As he sounded like he was getting nervous again, and he started rambling about how he would never do something like that, that it's not very often that someone will ask you to injure them on purpose. I mean, he goes like, when you fight, nobody's asking you to hurt them. And he made it clear that he's never gotten physical with women. and that he just did what she asked him to do. They asked James about the branding, the burn on her back, and he admitted that he did help her with that, that they had wood burning tools, either wood burning or leather burning. I don't even know if those things are interchangeable, but they asked if he still had the tool, and he said no, that they threw it in the trash. They asked him where he bought it from, and he told them at Hobby Lobby in Huntington Beach, that they bought the tools for about $20 or so. They asked him to explain what it was that they used to make the burn and how they did it. And James wanted to make it clear that this was all Sherry's idea. She thought up the whole thing of branding herself on the shoulder blade, and that he doesn't even really exactly remember what the branding said or what words they used. She just wanted it done. They asked James how it happened, and he wasn't really sure how to answer that, so the investigator clarified, just explained the whole process. Like, she woke up one morning and said, hey, let's go to Hobby Lobby, and James said no, she never left the house. She never went with him anywhere. That she knew that this had all blown up in the media, and he really didn't even know what her whole plan was and how this was all going to come to an end eventually. They asked James what they talked about for those 22 days, and he said, I mean, what are you going to talk about? She's in this weird situation. She's seeing herself on the news on her cell phone. James just didn't really know what to say or want to say anything because he didn't want to add to her stress or to the pressure that she was under. He said that he didn't know what her thoughts were about this whole thing, and that they didn't really talk about it. Even though she planned it all out, some of the stuff, some of the ideas she came up with at the spur of the moment, she would randomly come up with different ideas in terms of injuring herself. The investigators next asked James if he kept any of Sherry's clothing or if he held on to anything that might be evidence of his involvement, like if he had any proof that this was all 100% Sherry's doing. And James said, no, not really. There wasn't a lot of stuff that they had, that she wanted to toss everything out. But he said that he kind of wanted to keep the wood burning tool, but whatever it was, and she wanted to throw it all away. That it wasn't like they had a box or a kit of stuff prepared to do what she wanted done. When she needed something, she asked for it, and he would go get it. He mentioned that she wasn't starving, but she definitely looked like she needed a double-double even before this whole ordeal happened. He said that she wanted some sweats, and so he got her sweats. She wanted cleaning supplies, and he got her cleaning supplies. And that there wasn't really a whole bunch of stuff. He wasn't running around all the time for her. At this time, one of the investigators actually apologized to James for going off in all these directions with what Sherry actually did, because in his mind, he's still trying to process everything that's happening. He's trying to wrap his head around the whole thing because of how unique this case was for him. So they asked James, like, okay, so all you know is that she's in this really bad place with her husband, and she wanted to come down there with him to kind of try and figure things out. He wanted to know, at what point did Sherry start wanting to do all this stuff to hurt herself? And James said he really didn't know how long she was going to hold out for, that they talked about it, but he didn't really know what the plan was. Was she going to stay for a long time? Were they going to live together? There was just so much going on with the situation. He said, we had known each other for such a long time since they were young. They had been in love, but it was young love. That he didn't know if things were going to work out for her or what her next plan was going to be. He brought up meeting her dad for that beer at that hockey game. Apparently, I don't know when that happened, to tell you the truth. If it happened before the kidnapping or after the kidnapping hoax, I just don't know. James is back to rambling again. He brought up Sherry's kids again and how she almost died giving birth to the second child, but he's not even sure how much truth there is to that. Yeah, gee, I wonder why anyone would doubt Sherry Papini, right? But the problem was that after so many days down there with James, Sherry did start missing her kids. And you know, Dreamers, as much as I do not like Sherry, I can believe that to an extent. She's so narcissistic to begin with, just to be able to do that to her very young children in the first place is a testament to that. But as a parent, I still think that there's that part of you that just can't help feel that way about your kids. So at some point, she decided to go home on Thanksgiving Day. He said that somehow he was up for more than 2 days picking her up and then dropping her off again, including on Thanksgiving. And then afterwards, he went to his aunt's house in San Pedro. And after she made her big return, he drove back down and made an appearance by like 2 or 3 in the afternoon for Thanksgiving dinner. So next, the conversation started getting into when Sherry was dropped back off again. They asked about the things that she had with her. And James said she had stuff in the backseat of the car. Some of the stuff he bought, some of it he may have already had. Like the chain around her waist, he may have bought that, but he's not completely sure. He may have had it at his house. Just whatever he had purchased or had, she put it all together. But he's pretty sure he bought a length of chain for her at Ace Hardware. They asked how he paid for everything, and he said cash. The wood-burning tool, he said he paid cash for that too. They wanted to know if he purchased anything during this time for Sherry using a debit card or a credit card, but he really couldn't remember. They asked then what card he used to pay for the rental cars, and James admitted that he couldn't get a rental car because he had a DUI, so he had a buddy of his rent the cars for him. They asked him who rented the car for him, and he said it was this kid that used to work for him, just a young guy. He didn't know that any of this was happening with Sherry, and James provided them with the name of the person who got the rental cars for him. James said he asked him to rent the car, and he was like, yeah, for sure. Didn't ask any questions. James gave him cash for renting the car for him, and that he's pretty certain that he rented both cars from the same place. They asked him if he was by himself for both trips to pick up Sherry and to drop her off, and James confirmed that he was indeed by himself with Sherry. They next asked James about the phone. They said they knew his phone was turned off. They wanted to know whose idea it was to turn off the phone. James said that it could have died. And if I remember correctly from the Sherry confrontation video, they knew that they were talking to each other on burner phones, but James did say that he needed his regular phone on if she contacted him on that phone. But the investigators wanted to clarify that if he did turn off his phone on purpose to conceal his location, they wanted to know. But James really wouldn't commit to an answer to that question. They then asked James, who put everything on Sherry when she was released. He said that she was in the back seat the whole time, and everything she had on, he purchased. It was just very minimal. It wasn't like he was doing tons of shopping for her. She never left the house the whole time that she was there. They asked him where he shopped for all the stuff, and he said that he would go to Target or TJ Maxx or Ross or one of those discount type stores. They next asked James, when it came to the burning of Sherry's skin with the tools, where in the house did that happen? And James pointed out one of the 2 bedrooms. He said that the thing had to be plugged in. So the room where his grandma was staying is where the burning happened. They asked about the tools, if there were attachments, and James said, yeah. It was the first time he had ever used something like that, and it kind of looked like a small electric toothbrush with a handle. And then he said you just pop the letters on and it heats up like a soldering iron. Then they asked about more details and as far as how the burning tool worked, how to change the letters if the things are really hot. And they asked James what exactly was burned onto Sherry's skin, but he seemed to have a hard time remembering exactly. They asked him if he could remember the theme of what it was that was burned onto her skin, and he said honestly he couldn't remember, but it had some kind of meaning to her. I'll remind you, dreamers, that it was Bible verse Exodus 20:16, which says something to the effect of, whoever steals a man and sells him, anyone found in possession of him shall be put to death. Yeah, clearly it had some kind of meaning to her. She thought about this whole thing and making it out to be like this. She was trying to make it out to seem like she was being trafficked or some type of thing like that. The investigator then steers the questioning back to some specifics. He was the one who put the letters on. Where was Sherry when you did this? They asked, and he pointed out a chair in the room that was near an outlet because the tool needed to be plugged in. James got sidetracky again and started talking about how the carpeting at the time that Sherry was there was different, that he ended up pulling out the carpet, that he's lived there for about 10 years by that time, that they were talking to him and the carpet was kind of trashed, so he pulled it up, and now it's just kind of bare wood floors. They asked if Sherry was standing or laying down. If you recall, Sherry said that she was laid down on a table, kind of held down, and then the branding happened. But James clarified that she was either sitting in a chair or he was sitting on the floor, like behind her, that he really didn't know how to do something like that to someone. And it was weird for him to be asked by her to do this kind of burning on her skin. I mean, when you think about it, branding somebody like that, it's not something that's that easy to do. I don't think I would be able to do it. If someone was like, hey, burn this into my skin, my mind just goes straight to the hot metal and the smell of burning skin, which I have no idea what even smells like. But, okay, so I looked it up. Google says burning skin smells kind of like a charcoal-y kind of smell. Unfortunately, I looked that up while I was eating something at the same time. But I don't know what would be more difficult, sitting there taking the pain of being branded with hot pieces of metal or being the one actually doing it to someone. I mean, both scenarios seem totally awful. James then clarified that he believes that he sat on the ground behind her and did it. They asked him where the brand was at, and he said that it was somewhere on her shoulder or something. James pointed out that he's left-handed, so he thinks that he did it on her right shoulder blade and that he struggled with doing it because he was so nervous. He said that he actually dropped the burning tool because he was so nervous, and this was something that he had never done, but he didn't burn himself. It's just the thing was just so hot. Sherry wanted the words to be straight or the lettering to be as straight as possible, but it was really difficult for him, which is understandable. Then James asked the investigators if they'd ever done something like that, and they were like, no, we've never done anything like that. He said it can't be like deep, like cattle branding, because it would burn too deeply, and he just did it really quick, like he pressed it on her skin and took it right off. He again repeated that he went to the Hobby Lobby in Huntington Beach, and if you're familiar with the area, he said it's the Hobby Lobby just off the 405 at Beach Boulevard near the Belaterra Shopping Plaza. If you're really old school from Orange County and the surrounding area, then you might remember that the Belaterra sits where that shitty old Huntington Beach Mall used to be. Some of you have got to remember that place. I was just down in Huntington Beach at the end of January with a friend driving around in the middle of the night looking for a Tesla charging station at the Belaterra because I thought there might be one there, but it was actually at the Westminster Mall. Oh, shoot, Fred's barking. Anyway, I'm getting a little sidetracky now like James here. I just miss California sometimes and I like talking about it. So they asked James what Sherry did to deal with the pain of the burning, and James said that she really didn't complain all that much about it, that he didn't have any prescription pain medications for her, but he did give her some CBD liquid and maybe some Advils or something. They asked if he got her any burn cream, and he said, yeah, he got her some stuff for her skin because she got some kind of rash, which Sherry did talk about in her post-recovery interview. He said that she had some kind of allergic reaction to something, so he went to the store and looked around at the different creams that they had for irritated skin because he didn't really know what to get. She was trying to clean up some of the stains in the carpeting and broke out in hives, so she just had some kind of reaction to something. So yeah, I get it. I can be allergic to housework too. They asked about all the injuries, and James wanted to be clear that it was something that Sherry wanted. It was a thing that she asked him to do. There was nothing that he did to harm her on his own, that this was a completely mutual thing. The investigators asked if they were sexually active during this time, and James said no, not even at all. They asked if she took her shirt off for the branding, and James said that she kind of just pulled it up, but that was it. They had been together in the past, but She was never around him during this time without clothes on or walking around naked or anything like that. He brought up the fact that Sherry had breast implants, but she ended up falling down at some point and had to go back to have another surgery to fix whatever happened, but it was giving her a lot of problems and discomfort. He said that he kind of made fun of her about it and told her that one of her boobs looks a little saggy. James then went off topic again and started talking about what she was doing and what this meant for him, what the implications were. I mean, it's not off topic, but they're asking him about the contact that they had, and he starts talking about him possibly getting in trouble. If he was going to be getting in trouble or anyone in his family because of this, remember, all of this stuff was all over the news. It had blown up. He said that he had been in trouble with the law in the past, that his mom had been to prison too, but he wasn't too nervous about dealing with law enforcement because he's been there, done that for the better part of his adult life. James eventually steered back to not having had any type of sexual contact with Sherry at all while she was at his place. They didn't really talk about it all that much. She did mention that she can't get pregnant anymore, and he did say that Sherry is a pretty sick person. The agent asked James if he was hoping to have sex with her, and he said, no, not really. This wasn't a sexual thing at all. The whole thing with Sherry had him pretty rattled. And I'm sure having the FBI at your door doesn't make things any better, but at this point, you know, it kind of sounds like somewhat of a relief for James to get all of this mess off of his chest, you know? He's talking pretty freely, and this is an hour and a half into this conversation at this point. He said that he had a lot going on in his life, taking care of his grandmother now that his dad and his uncle had passed away, that he has one aunt, his grandmother's daughter, but they don't get along, so he's been saddled with taking care of her for the past few years. The investigators then asked James a little bit more about his family, his aunt, the one who lives in San Pedro, and his mom and his brother Cody, who live in Big Bear. His other brother Nick had lived there at the house that Sherry was at some point. They had a falling out, and he moved to Big Bear with his kid and moved in with his mom. They asked if Sherry was ever in Big Bear, which would be what they may have suspected was the rural area that Sherry described with the gravel driveway. But James said no, she was never in Big Bear, and nobody ever visited them during the time that she was staying with him. They asked about the phone that Sherry was using while she was down there with him, and he said that she had a phone with her. She used it the whole time, and that he believed it to be a prepaid phone. He wasn't sure what kind of phone she had, but he did know that she left her phone, her regular iPhone, and brought a different one with her. They asked him if he could describe the phone, and he said it was black and either a Samsung or an iPhone, but it was a smartphone. They asked James what she did with the phone when she went back home, and he said she threw it away, that everything she had with her, she tossed it. He wasn't home a lot during that time because he worked and played hockey every day, so whatever she was doing, whatever she had, when she was ready to go back, they threw everything away, but it wasn't very much stuff to begin with. And then he pointed over to the dumpster where they threw everything out, which I'm sure was very disappointing for the investigators. But it had been almost 4 years since this whole thing happened, so the chances of James having anything of Sherry's from that time were probably pretty slim. I'm sure they would have loved to have had that burner phone so they could see what Sherry was looking at during those 22 days. Probably reading about her own dumbass all over the news. But anyway, James said that his part in all of this was to transport Sherry from Shasta County down to Orange County and then back to Shasta County, that everything was all on her. They asked James if he followed the case in the aftermath and in the ensuing years, and he said that he did, that he was curious about it. He didn't think she was in a good mental state. It had been a lot of years since they had last talked, and he really didn't know much about her situation. All he knew was that she had some issues and she wanted to come down and stay with him. They asked him how long the planning process was, and he said it wasn't very long. They talked about it for a couple of months before he actually went up there and picked her up. He said that he worked so much that it was difficult and exhausting for him to do those two round trips like that. When they got to the Los Angeles area, he was really having a hard time staying awake. Because, you know, coming and going from Los Angeles to Orange County is no joke on the 405. or the 5 freeway. Either freeway is a mess. It's a drive that, if there was no traffic, would take maybe 20, 25 minutes, and it could take easily 2 to 3 hours if it's trafficy and backed up, which it was. It really sucks. It even seems like there's traffic all the time now, not just during like rush hour. There's traffic all the time. James again reiterated that that was all that happened. They didn't go anywhere. They talked when he was home. They shared some meals. They hung out, but she never left his house. She spent a lot of the time by herself. She had all the privacy that she needed. She did a lot of reading and listening to music. A lot of the time, she just wanted to be in the room by herself with the door shut. The investigators asked him about the window in the bedroom next. Did she do anything to the window? And James said that there were some boards over the window, so she couldn't see out and nobody could see in, and that there was barely any sunlight coming into the room at all. They asked him who put the boards up over the windows, and James said that he was the one that did that, that he screwed them into the wall for her. They asked him where he got the wooden boards from, and he said he had already had them, that he had gotten these boards from the Home Depot, and that he had built himself a workbench in the garage, and that these were some leftover wood boards, that it was just 3 sheets of plywood. The investigators mentioned that they did still see the holes in the walls from where the boards were put up. Then James said that he had the boards up on the windows previously. They asked him if he was growing marijuana, and James was like, yeah, and the landlord knew about it. So James had boards up, but he took them down, but he put them back up for Sherry while she was there. He said that he was growing marijuana in the room, but he accidentally flooded the room and had to pull the carpet out, and he ceased using the room as a grow room. They asked if Sherry wanted it dark all the time, and he said, yep. The carpet was still in the room when she was there, but in the intervening time, that's when he pulled the carpet out. I believe he said he pulled it up in February of 2020, so about 6 months before the investigators actually got there. The investigators next asked James about the stuff that he looked up about the case and all the stress that he may have been under. What all was he thinking? James said that, well, he has common sense. Yeah, okay. Whatever happens is going to happen. He's not going to run from anything. They pointed out that he didn't come running to them either to report what Sherry had done. He said that he figured that he might get in trouble, maybe not, but what it all came down to for him was that he was trying to do a favor for an old friend. And he realized then how severe the case was and how long it carried on. But the investigator said to him, yeah, but how can we prove that all of this was consensual? If there's anything that he can show them that what he's saying is the truth, did he write anything down? Did he keep a journal? Did he have any pictures? Anything at all to corroborate his story? But James really didn't have anything but his word. And you know, honestly, he's believable. And at the end of the day, Sherry ended up pleading guilty. James was never charged with any crimes, even though they did tell Sherry when they confronted her with the information that they got from James that he implicated himself in some felonies. Why would he do that to himself if he was going to lie to us? Why would he get himself in trouble? You'll understand a little bit more later on. I know these audio clips are sometimes difficult to listen to, but the one that I really think that you're going to want to hear is the very last one, when they break the news to Sherry that they found James and that they know the whole truth. Because Sherry, when they did confront her, still wasn't going to budge from her story. Not at that time, anyway. They asked if he had spoken to her since the time that he dropped her back off, and he said no, that he hadn't spoken to her. They asked him if he kept anything at all to prove that this was all her doing in the case. The whole thing, if it backfired, if she goes and makes the claim that he actually kidnapped her, did he have any insurance to protect himself? And he said no, that he just took the chance and trusted her. But he pointed out that it goes both ways because they could implicate each other. He said it was kind of like whatever happens, happens. This was more than just a favor. This was a huge ask. James did also say that this whole thing cost him a lot of money too. And they asked him how much he thought he may have spent on the 2 rental cars and the gas and the wood burning tools, the clothes, the food, the medications, etc. And he said the cars were about $300 to $400, and all the incidentals, he probably spent around $1,000, mainly because of the cost of the rental cars. They then asked him for the phone number of his buddy who rented the cars for him. That's the one thing that they can look into to corroborate the story. James said, yeah, he still has his number, and they asked for it so they could start trying to confirm some of his story, but James brought up again how his phone is broken, but he was going to get another one that day, and they showed up at his door when he was about to head out to get a new phone, and his data will transfer over. But he said that he would text the phone number to them as soon as he gets his phone up and running. He said that he would even talk to his friend and let him know that it's okay to talk to the investigators about the rental cars, that he shouldn't have a problem speaking with them. The investigators confirmed again that it was just James and Sherry that made both drives. There were no females in the car. I guess they're, part of them wanted to believe some parts of the story, and she kept insisting there's two women. She even came up with sketches of them. And he said, no, James said no females involved. It was just them. They asked him if he saw the composite sketches of the women that Sherry described. And James was like, yeah, no, that wasn't even a thing. There's just no way. Those women in the sketches were a complete figment of Sherry's whack imagination. James said that when he saw the sketches, it made him laugh because it was so ridiculous. But he admitted that he wasn't planning on ever turning himself in. If he was going to get in trouble for this, the trouble would come and find him, which it kind of did. He said that he's not going to fight the charges if he's charged. He's not going to run from anything. He's already resigned himself to the fact that he's going to get in trouble for his part in this case, then so be it. They asked James if his cousin who lived on the same block ever saw Sherry while she was there, and he said no, but he knew that she was there. They asked how he knew, and James said that he told him that they have a close relationship, so he wasn't ever going to say anything. He trusted him. But he'd be around soon. He was at work. If they wanted to speak to him too, he would be back that afternoon. They told James that they needed to speak to anybody who could corroborate the things that he was telling them. So anybody that they can call that was in the know about this, they want to talk to. At that point, James said that he would try to power on his phone, that it might turn on, it just won't hold a charge. Towards the end of the conversation, James talked about how he ended up showing up at his aunt's house on Thanksgiving. I believe he said that he took Sherry with him, dropped her off in the early morning hours of Thanksgiving, and then drove back and made an appearance. And after that, he drove his grandma home and went to bed. He was so dead tired from the lack of sleep. He also mentioned how he had brought Sherry to this same aunt's house for Thanksgiving during the time that they were dating, sometime around 2002, he believed. So his family did know her. So just to clarify, James said that he went to his aunt's house for Thanksgiving and brought his grandma with him. After that, he took his grandma back home. He took Sherry back first and then came back down for Thanksgiving dinner. Sometimes with James's rambling, it's really hard to pick up all of the details of everything, and the way that he says things is kind of awkward. They asked James, when they go and speak to his cousin about Sherry, what is he going to tell them? And James said that his cousin knows that Sherry was at his house during the time that she was missing, but he really doesn't know much else. He did see the news and whatever was in the media. He will know all that. But as far as Sherry's time down in Costa Mesa, all he knew was that she was at his house and he never saw her. Just knew that she was there. His cousin wouldn't know much about the things that he was buying for Sherry. He wouldn't be able to confirm those details. The only thing that he would be able to confirm is that she was in fact there. They asked again, so he never saw her. He never talked to her, no interactions. And James said no. They never made any kind of contact in those 22 days. James did say that his cousin did come knocking on the door one night, drunk, when Sherry was there in the room, but James had the house locked up, and he had already told his cousin what was going on and that he wasn't thinking that he was doing anything wrong or illegal because Sherry was asking for all of this to be done. James said that his mom saw the news and asked him about it, so he told her too, but all these people kept it a secret. His mom was curious but didn't ask too many questions, but they had all seen it on the news, and His mom, when she saw Sherry had gone missing, she tried calling James but didn't pry too much. And he didn't say anything to his mom when she initially called, but as the news kept blowing up, he eventually told her that Sherry was hiding at his place. And since then, James has just been waiting for the whole saga to play out and see what happens. The conversation carried on about who knew what and who the investigators are going to talk to next, but you can just really hear it in the voice of the investigator speaking to James that he is just tripping out on everything that he's learning from this guy. I can't imagine trying to investigate this weird kidnapping mystery for almost 4 years, and then with one DNA match, you get the full story from the guy that helped Sherry do what she did. It's just crazy. It's like hitting the investigative jackpot, right? So they circle back to talking about the rental cars again. The one that James had to go pick Sherry up the first time. Sherry had said it was an SUV, but James said no, it was a Dodge Challenger, which he was kind of annoyed with because of all the gas it was going to cost him to drive a car like that up and down the state of California. Sherry had said that she had gotten into the back of an SUV when she was kidnapped and laid down on the floor of the back seat. James confirmed that no, she was in the back seat. There was no room to lay down on the floor. The Challenger is a two-door car. It's very small and cramped, but it was already rented and there was nothing that he could do about it. The second rental car that they got was an SUV. James told them how he had breakfast when he got to Redding, that he went to Trader Joe's, and then he went to Starbucks. He said that he was just waiting for her to let him know where to pick her up from. He wasn't just sitting on that road where she was jogging, waiting for her to come by. They got into talking next about the burner phones that he had purchased at Sherry's request. He said that he got them at the AT&T store near where he lived, and that they used the phones for the 20 or so days that she was there. He said that she already had another burner phone from her job, as she apparently worked for AT&T. So to me, it kind of sounds like Sherry had been having a second prepaid phone all along. James said she got it from her work, so I wouldn't put it past her to have the second phone in order to carry on her shenanigans even before the kidnapping, because we know from her interrogation that she was talking to other men. That was her excuse for everything. In the end, her whole excuse was like she was seeing too many other men. James said that they mostly just texted. They didn't make a lot of phone calls to each other during the time of the kidnapping hoax. The investigators really wanted to go digging into as many phone records as they could. They next asked him to consent to a search of the house so that they could take more pictures, to which James readily agreed. He's being super cooperative, and he's very lucky that they decided to not charge him with lying to a federal agent, because he was lying to them for basically the first hour of the conversation. So the investigators next asked James, The investigators next asked James if he would be willing to take a polygraph examination, and he agreed to that too. And I do know that he did pass the polygraph with flying colors. It gets brought up in the next audio clip that I'm going to upload after this one. Keith was also subjected to a polygraph, but his came up inconclusive. I can't help but wonder if Keith just knew that Sherry had a few screws loose and he was doing his best to hold up under the pressure. They then asked James what he thought Sherry would say if he texted her out of the blue and said the FBI wants to talk to him. What do you want him to say or do? James said that he has no idea what she would say, that he hasn't spoken to her since he dropped her off. He surmised that she would probably not respond, even if she still has his number, which he said has been his number forever. So who knows? Sherry seems to have thought this scheme out pretty thoroughly, and so it would lead me to think that she may have deleted James from her contacts. But Keith did mention in the final audio clip that we're going to hear next that he had provided law enforcement with James's number. So we know to an extent that Keith knew of him enough to provide his phone number to the FBI when the kidnapping happened, which seems weird because I don't think I would have my husband knowing any of my ex-boyfriend's phone numbers, but whatever. They asked James if he would be willing to contact Sherry to see what she would say, and James, again, agreed that he would do that if they wanted him to. But then when they discussed it further, the investigators couldn't remember if Sherry had a different number in 2020 than she did back in 2016, and it would be kind of suspicious if all of a sudden James texted her out of the blue to a number that he really shouldn't have had in the first place. So a couple hours into this recording, a woman appeared in the audio. And at first I couldn't figure out who it was, but the investigators wanted to speak to her, and so James asked her to come talk to them. It turns out she's married to his cousin, Robert, who lives up the street. So this woman comes into the room, and the birds are like chirping like crazy in the background. They tell her to not be scared, that they're there investigating the Sherry Papini case. She was the one who was abducted out of Northern California. And this woman was like, oh, yeah, yeah, I heard about that in the news. And they said that they were there talking to James and him knowing her around that time. And she asked, do you mean when they dated a long time ago? And the investigator said, no, during the time of the abduction. He said that she might have some information. She might know something. Did James tell you that Sherry was here at his house during this time? And the woman kind of hesitated and said, we kind of kept it. I mean, we just didn't really talk about it. They asked her what she knew. She said that there was something about a bad relationship with her husband and that she was just trying to get away or something. So she told James, okay, well, whatever it is, it's probably best for me to not know anything about it. So I just told him I'd rather not know anything. But she said that she did know that Sherry was James's ex-girlfriend, and she remembers seeing the story in the media. The investigators reassure this woman that they're not there trying to get anyone in trouble. They just want to see how much they can prove what James is telling them is the truth. They told her that they know that she was there at the house, but she interjected and said that she actually never physically saw Sherry at James's house. She just knows that James had said something about her, but she just really didn't want to know. But she was under the impression that he was trying to help her or protect her from this bad relationship or from something bad happening to her, but she doesn't know all the details. They asked her, so you never talked to Sherry or anything while she was there? And she said, no, I never talked to her. I never saw her. This woman never even met Sherry. She said that she doesn't know what James knows or if they talked extensively about what she did with James. They asked her if, even though she doesn't know the details, does she know when and how she got picked up? And the woman said no. She just knew when she was dropped back off, not the date and time. She just remembered that James told her that Sherry was gone. He didn't necessarily tell her that he went back up north to drop her off, but she just remembered him telling her that she left. So I don't know what this woman who the investigators are talking to looks like, but I do know that James is Hispanic. So this woman, she might be too. The investigators asked her if she thinks that Sherry may have used her image as part of her composite drawings. So I'm assuming that they think that she is somewhat similar features as the women, or at least one of the women in the sketches, but the woman said that she never met Sherry, so she doesn't know how that would happen. But I guess it's possible that Sherry saw pictures of this woman with James's cousin, maybe on social media, maybe there at James's house. They know that Sherry blended in some truth into her fictional tale, so I wish I knew what this woman looked like. I'd be kind of offended because those composite sketches were weird and ugly. But she did say that James told her and her husband to not come over, that there was something going on with Sherry and to just stay away from the house while she's there. She wasn't sure what was going on with Sherry and her husband or if there was some domestic violence issues going on. She was under the impression that Sherry was afraid for her life, so it was important that they just stayed away and didn't say anything to anyone. And that James said that he was protecting her by hiding her for a little while. She said that James said that she was going to try to get away, but he still cared for her very much. And then she pointed out, before long, James started coming around again to hang out with them, And that's when he told them that Sherry had left. And James pretty much got his life back after babysitting Sherry for 22 days. He's a strange guy, but that's some dedication on his part. But, you know, if I had a friend that I felt like was in trouble, I'd probably do the same. Sherry is such a bitch to be treating people that care about her like this. It's really irritating and annoying that she just uses and manipulates everyone around her, including all of us who followed the story and wondered and felt terrible for what she went through. She brought up thinking that Keith had some connections in law enforcement, this woman that the investigators are talking to, or that he was in law enforcement and Sherry wasn't able to get the help that she needed because everyone was on Keith's side. The investigators asked if James ever asked her to get involved, and she was like, nope, not at all. James was busy working all the time, and he would come home for several weeks and would just stay locked up inside his house. They asked her if this was normal for James to be holed up in his house like this, and she said, like, no, not at all. He would normally come by pretty regularly, but while Sherry was there, he felt like he needed to be at home if he wasn't at work. They asked her to call her husband, but she told the investigators that she had just called him before she started talking to them and that he had to call her back because he was dealing with some real estate stuff with their grandma and he couldn't talk. So she didn't think that he would be able to talk to them at that time. So the woman finally told the investigators her name is Louisa. So they asked if Sherry, she asked if Sherry was okay. Has she been okay? And the investigator was like, yeah, she's been fine. We just never really knew the truth about what happened to her. And Louisa said, yeah, you know, I don't think James ever said how she was doing. She never asked about Sherry. She just wanted to distance herself from the whole mess. The stuff that she had seen on the news, she felt like the whole thing was so weird and dramatic. Remember the condition that Sherry was found in. She did have some extensive injuries, bruises, the burn on her shoulder. Her hair was cut. Her nose was broken. She was released in the very early morning hours. She had a chain around her waist and one of her wrists was attached with the hose clamp. So these people are seeing all this being reported in the news, but they all knew that she was perfectly safe with James the whole time. So yeah, it did seem really weird because they knew James would not have done all that to her. Well, unless she asked him to. But it doesn't seem like he ever told anyone what they did during those 3 weeks to cause all those injuries. I probably wouldn't tell anyone either because not only would my friends and family think Sherry was a nutcase, they'd probably think that I was one too for helping a friend do something like that to herself. So the investigator said that Louisa's husband might know the context of everything that happened, but Louisa said that he knew of Sherry from years ago when she was dating James, but he doesn't know this Sherry. He didn't know all that happened either while she was hiding at James's house. While she was there, James barely talked to either one of them at all. Of course, they didn't talk to Sherry. Her husband never visited them. He never came over to their house. James completely shut down for all those weeks that she was there, which was not normal for him. So when the news came out, they were like blown away by how dramatic Sherry was about what she had done. They had no idea that she had staged the whole thing since they knew James would never hurt her like that. She said at the time of the kidnapping was going on that she was working. Louisa said that she was working. Robert was working. The kids were going to school. They were just doing their normal day-to-day lives. And all the while, this whole big drama was unfolding in the news and at James's house. She followed the news and she remembered reading about Sherry in a magazine at her hair salon. The agent finally gave her a business card and asked her to have her husband give him a call when he has some free time to talk, telling her that the news reports and everything say that Sherry was a victim of an abduction, but James is directly contradicting that. All those reports by telling them that she did all of this for 22 days voluntarily on her own, that it was all her idea, and that they needed to speak to people who could back up James' story, as they've been trying to get to the truth for almost 4 years by then. And Louisa was like, yeah, she totally gets it. And she even told James, when all the drama played out in the media behind Sherry's supposed abduction, that he should stay the heck away from her and her mess. but that James is such a caring, sweet person that he had no hesitation to help when he felt like she was in need and in trouble. He just wanted her to be safe. For whatever reason, she came running to him, and he just wanted to help. And then she ended up turning it into all this drama in the media, and she really didn't know what to think because all she had to go on was what she saw in the news. The investigators asked Louisa if there was anything else about Sherry that she thought that they should know, and she said, you know, when she was in a relationship with not only James but also with her husband, she ended up leaving him for another man and taking a $20,000 ring that he gave her. That just shows tidbits about Sherry. She said that Sherry was really rude to her husband when they were younger. Louisa said that Sherry really didn't like her husband back then and that she kind of just used him. And that sounds pretty consistent with Sherry's history and behavior. She used and manipulated people that were close to her, including her own parents and her own sister. Louisa also said that Sherry was a serial cheater as well. She was never faithful. But aside from that, she doesn't know very much else about Sherry. She had never met her, but she saw her on TV and she was like, wow, she's really pretty. But she would probably be recognizable if anyone encountered her on the street. Sherry, on the surface, maybe she looks all right, but it seems and feels so fake because she's such an ugly person in every other way that it just takes away from whatever superficial beauty that you think she might have. And to me, when you look at her pictures and you just look into her eyes, Sherry Papini will scare the holy hell out of you. I showed a friend of mine who really doesn't follow true crime Sherry's picture, and he was like, wow, she looks evil. And all I told him was that she tried to pull off her own kidnapping hoax. I didn't even tell him the details, and that was his takeaway when he looked at the pictures of her just off the top of the Google searches. And with that, that was the end of the conversation with Louisa. So James is back in the conversation, and they just asked him more details about the drive down from Northern California when he first picked Sherry up, where they stopped, and what time they got back to Costa Mesa. I'm assuming that they took the 5 freeway most of the way. That does take you through Los Angeles, which held them up for a few hours. The drive back took an extra 2 to 3 hours because of the Los Angeles traffic, so it was late when they got into Orange County. When they got back, he went right to bed because he had to go to work in the morning. They asked how Sherry got into the house without being seen, and James said it was pretty late and nobody was really out and about at that time. He pulled up to the house and she slipped inside under the cover of darkness, that she just walked herself in. She wasn't restrained. She wasn't forced at gunpoint. None of that took place, which is what Sherry's story had been all those years. James said that he parked the rental car out in front and took it back the next morning before he went to work. The investigators then asked about the first night as they drove down, what their conversations were about. James said that it was just regular small talk kind of stuff, but they really didn't talk all that much about what was going on with her. He wasn't giving her the third degree about why she was doing what she was doing. He didn't want to pick on her and he didn't want to pry, but they just talked about what was going on in their lives, what was new. She talked about her children and how she was choosing to do this and leave them like this. And he said that she also was worried about her kids. She knew when James picked her up that morning on that jog that her children were going to be left abandoned at the daycare. And you know what? That just pisses me off that she would do something like that. I don't know what her custody situation turned out to be, but I wouldn't be surprised if her access to her children was limited after the news broke that this whole thing was fake. You will hear Keith say in the next audio clip that he doesn't want her anywhere near him or his home or his kids. And he was asking the investigators what he has to do to keep her away. And they said that he's probably going to have to file for a restraining order. I don't know if he did that or not, or if he tried, but I do know that he filed for divorce in April of 2022. And in his filings, he outlined the trauma he was put through in this whole mess that she created. But anyway, James said for the most part that the drive was quiet, that they really didn't have all that much to talk about. And he pointed out what it would take for someone to be able to do what she did, to put herself through this fake kidnapping, that like mentally, he doesn't understand how someone could do what she did and that he didn't think he would be capable of it. Yeah, because people don't do stuff like this to themselves very often. It's very strange and weird. So the investigators asked James when they got there, did he have her all set up in the room or what? And James said, well, when she arrived, his place was pretty thrashed and they made do. And eventually he started clearing out the room and she started cleaning. They asked if there was a bed in the room and he said that there was, and that the frame that was in there was currently the same frame that he had when she stayed with him, but the mattress he replaced about a year ago. So they did get to see and take pictures of the actual IKEA bed frame that Sherry slept on for those 3 weeks, but not the mattress. They asked him where he slept, and he said he slept on the couch in the living room, that he gets up early every day to go play hockey, and then he goes to work. And he just had a morning routine where he would get up early and tell Sherry he'd see her later and leave for most of the day. They then asked James if he would leave for the day and come back if he would notice different or new injuries on Sherry. And James said not really, that the injuries started happening as it was getting closer to the time that Sherry was preparing to go back home. They asked how long that time frame was when she was doing all these injuries to herself. And James said it wasn't really that long. She was getting ready to go back home. And a couple of days before, she wanted to start making all these injuries on her body. So technically, Sherry wasn't kicking her own ass for 22 days like I had hypothesized in the last commentary episode, but she still kicked her own ass. She did that stuff. James actually said that Sherry wanted to stay longer, but she started having a hard time being away from her kids and decided that enough was enough and got ready to reappear. He said that when they left for her to go back, it was already dark and in the evening, and he had no idea where he was going. They just drove, and he just went along with whatever Sherry told him to do. They next asked him about the burn on Sherry's forearm. How did that happen? And James thought for a minute, but he said that he didn't know. So Sherry probably did that without his knowledge on her own, which is what he said. Most of what happened to her was self-inflicted. He was already weirded out by the whole branding thing. That was the only thing that he really helped her out with. That, and I think he broke her nose and banking hockey pucks off her shins, which is a lot to do to someone. I couldn't do it. Man or woman, I could not be a part of that mess at all. So more power to James, I guess. He must have really wanted to help or cared enough. I don't know. I don't get it. I seriously don't get what either one of them were thinking, to be honest. They then asked James again about the boarding up of the windows. They wanted to know when he put the boards back up over the windows, and he said it was a couple of days into the kidnapping. He didn't do it the night that she got there, but a couple of days later, she asked him to do it. The windows were situated in a way that if a neighbor did happen to peer over like the backyard fence or whatever, they might be able to see inside the window of the room that she was in. James said that the room was full of his junk and he had just been piling stuff up in there. It was like a storage room. And so it took him a while to move everything out of the room and get it set up for Sherry to stay in. Then they asked about what she ate, as they're realizing now that Sherry was free to eat whatever she wanted. Remember how she described getting cream of wheat and like lumpy cold cream of wheat and scraps of food, a cracker, some rice, a tortilla. James was like, she ate whatever he purchased and had in the kitchen. He said she wasn't starving because she didn't have access to food. Rather, she was not eating as much because she was obviously trying to purposely lose weight for her big comeback. She was the one that restricted her own diet. She was already thin to begin with, but she got even thinner. They next asked about the cutting of the hair. How did all that happen? And he just said Sherry chopped off her own hair herself. They asked in what time frame did that happen, and James said it was pretty early on, within the first few days that she was there, but he wasn't home when she did it. He just came home one day and her hair was lopped off. They asked where the hair went, and he just said that he assumed she threw it in the trash, but he didn't know for sure because he never saw it. They asked if any other blondes had been in the house before or since, and he said no. It had been a long time since he dated a blonde. And we do know that they found some strands of Sherry's hair in his home. Even years later, there was still evidence of her presence in that house. They then asked James if he was aware of the reward information about Sherry's whereabouts, and James got a little bit defensive at this point, that he'd been working since he was a teenager. This was never about reward money. He didn't even know about it until some time had passed, and he just saw it in the news or in the media. But at the time, when she was hiding out at his place, he said he didn't know about the money. And since he was just trying to put this all behind him, he was sort of at peace with everything. He wasn't sure what was going to happen to Sherry or to him. He was just going on with his life. They next asked James how much time between the branding and when she started to return home, and he said it was within days, definitely the same week that she went home. They asked about the rash, and James said that he did get her some cream for it, but it never really went away. And the investigators were like, yeah, she still had it when she came back. James admitted that his place was a pigsty, so it doesn't surprise him that she would break out in hives. They talked more about the drop-off, and James said that he had no clue where they were or where they were going, but Sherry had the drop-off spot planned out. He just followed her directions. He said when they got off the freeway, they ended up near some kind of open field, that she had been in the back seat the whole time, and she put all that stuff on, the chain and the hose clamp on herself. He said it was so dark and he couldn't hardly see anything in the area where he dropped her off at. The investigators then bring up having professional pictures taken of his house. They pointed out that there were some things that Sherry described about the house that were true and other things that were false, and they wanted to gather as much information as they could to try and figure everything out, like what is real and what is fake. They also started talking to James about potentially going down to the local FBI office there in Orange County the next day in order for him to take a polygraph test. And they tell him that it's going to be time consuming, but James seems willing to cooperate and he's willing to take the polygraph. This is during the height of COVID-19. This interview, like I said, is taking place in August of 2020. So James has pointed out that he's barely left the house in like 6 months and he's been busy taking care of his grandmother, but he would be willing to go. They told James that it would take him away from his grandma for a while, and then an option that they have is to have a paramedic come and stand by while he does the polygraph. And that seemed to be cool with James too, but he said maybe his aunt in San Pedro might be able to come take care of her, but the priority for these investigators is to make sure that grandma's taken care of, but they really, really want him to take this polygraph test like the next day. Then James suddenly remembered a detail. He had been hospitalized with some kind of blood infection in the time leading up to the kidnapping, to a point where he almost lost a leg. But he recovered, and when he went home, he had actually received a care package from Sherry. He said that they had already been talking about this kidnapping plan, so when he got out of the hospital, there was this package there waiting for him from her. And in this package, there was some tea and some lotion, a map, and a letter. And Sherry hadn't settled on a date at that point yet when she wanted this carried out. But yeah, this was in the late summer of 2016, just months before the staged abduction. They eventually settled on a date through text messaging, that the date wasn't specified in the letter that she wrote to him. And it was after he got the care package that he purchased the burner phone, and that's how they began communicating about the plan. The investigator then tells James that they're going to bring the FBI forensics teams to process the house, and James was like, whoa, wait, what about my neighbors? And they were just like, we have no control over that. Like, this is a crime scene. We're going to send our guys in to take care of it. This is technically Sherry's crime scene, and it has to be done. And they do need to get a DNA swab directly from James in order to confirm that it was his DNA on her clothing. At that point, the investigators mark the time and the interview ends and they cut off the recording. And that is all I have to say about the James Reyes interview. I hope this was a little bit easier of a listen than the actual audio. Next up is the climactic end of this whole thing when the investigators confront Sherry. Also in August of 2020, they don't wait very long with the fact that they found James Reyes. They've been to the house and he confessed to everything. It's my favorite out of all the audio clips related to this case. And after that, we are going to move on. I think I want to cover a story out of Florida. It's been a minute since we've been down to that state. And to be honest, I'm a little bit bored with California cases at the moment. I think I've covered the ones that have fascinated me the most through the years. There have been so many good stories from all over the United States and lots of stuff that's happened since COVID too. I have a really good one though. This was earlier. This was about 10 years ago or so. A little more than 10 years ago, this story out of Florida that I want to do. And it's a good one in that it's interesting due to the fact that so many people conspired to kill this one person. And it's just strange to me how people came to this agreement about killing somebody and then actually went through with it. But anyway, that'll be after we wrap up Sherry Papini. I want to thank you all so much for listening. And as always, until next time, sweet dreams.